many more stroke victims get the help they need on time. This Moment of Science comes from Indiana University with production support from the Brabson Foundation. Today's program was prepared by Jeremy Shear with help from Olajide Williams at Columbia University. I'm Yael Cassander.
It's 2:40. In sports, Nelson Figueroa pitched 4 1/3 scoreless innings for the New York Mets this afternoon and boosted the offense with a 2-run triple, leading New York over the St. Louis Cardinals 9-0, a shutout today in New York. The Chicago Cubs go for a sweep of their 3-game series with Cincinnati tonight. Chicago is 3-2 so far during this 10-game road trip. With 9 wins in their last 12 home games, the Chicago White Sox have pulled within a game of the American League Central Division-leading Detroit Tigers. The Sox continue their series with the Los Angeles Angels tonight. Buick, which was the oldest continuous sponsor of the PGA Tour, is ending more than 50 years of sponsorship of men's golf. According to people with knowledge of the deal, the just-concluded Buick Open in Michigan will be replaced on the PGA schedule by a new tournament at the Greenbrier in West Virginia. That's sports.
Today's broadcast is funded in part by a grant from the Illinois Arts Council, a state agency.
Amazon will be facing pressure from Sony. Today, Sony has introduced 2 digital reading devices, the Touch and the Pocket, which will compete with Amazon's The Kindle. NPR's Lynn Neary reports.
The Touch has a touchscreen panel with a built-in dictionary and sophisticated note-taking capabilities, but it's the Pocket that's likely to stir interest. Its screen is 5 inches, smaller than other devices, and at $199, less expensive, too. Sony Vice President Brennan Mullen.
At $199, we hope to really break a new barrier in terms of pricing and hopefully make digital reading available to a larger audience.
Sarah Rotman Epps, a media analyst for Forrester Research, says the $199 price is a coup for Sony. But she adds the market for these readers is still limited.
This is not Joe Schmo on the corner. These are for people who really love to read and read a lot of books. And for that segment, $199 is a great price point.
Sony is also bringing down the price of books available at its e-book store from $11.99 to $9.99, the current price of a book at Amazon's Kindle store. And through a partnership with Google, Sony's customers will have access to 1 million public domain books for free. But the Sony readers still won't have the same wireless capability that the Kindle has. Sony Vice President Brennan Mellon says they're working on that. Lynn Neary, NPR News, Washington.
The Swiss bank UBS is working on bringing back wealthy customers scared off by the bank's dispute with the U.S. government. Last week, UBS and U.S. officials reached a settlement involving 52,000 of the bank's American customers. U.S. officials believe many of those customers are evading taxes. The investigation threatens Switzerland's legendary bank secrecy. But as NPR's Greg Allen reports, it looks like this deal will leave most accounts secret.
Going into the lawsuit, the U.S. had a strong case. UBS is Switzerland's largest bank, one that in recent years greatly expanded its U.S. presence. 2 years ago, the Justice Department began an investigation that found the company conspired to help wealthy Americans set up secret bank accounts that would help them evade paying taxes. In February, UBS reached an agreement with the U.S. government in which it admitted wrongdoing and agreed to pay a fine of $780 million. At the same time, it turned over to the U.S. information on a couple of 100 account holders whose names were discovered in the investigation. For the IRS and the Justice Department, that wasn't enough. The government filed a lawsuit seeking the names of all 52,000 American citizens and residents with secret UBS accounts. But on Friday, just before the case was to go to trial in Miami, at a photo op with the Swiss Foreign Minister, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton confirmed there was a settlement.
There has been an understanding between the Swiss government and our government over the ongoing litigation concerning UBS.
For months, U.S. officials insisted that they were going to trial and would settle for nothing less than full disclosure from UBS. Scott Michael, a partner with Kaplan and Drysdale, a Washington firm representing many UBS account holders, says what changed things was the involvement of the Swiss government. Switzerland places great value on its bank secrecy laws. The Swiss government said publicly that it would seize UBS records rather than allow the company to hand over secret account information to U.S. authorities. Michael says it gave UBS a great defense.
UBS would have gone to the judge and said, "Your Honor, there's nothing we can do. We don't have this information. The government has seized it from us." And in all likelihood, that might have ended the case.
Details of the settlement are still being negotiated. Reuters is reporting that U.S. officials are not seeking a fine. Also, that the settlement will require UBS to hand over the names of about 5,000 U.S. account holders, just 10% of what the government originally wanted.
I would like to have seen the 52,000 names.
Raymond Baker is the director of Global Financial Integrity, a Washington group that advocates for tougher international scrutiny of tax havens. He wanted to see the case go to trial. Settling for less than full disclosure from UBS, he believes, is a lost opportunity.
I would have liked to have seen Swiss bank secrecy as far as its dealings with the United States come to an end.
Even though any settlement is likely to be less than what the government was seeking, Reuven Aviyona, an international tax law expert at the University of Michigan, believes it's still a significant win for the U.S.
5,000 names is not such a small amount of names, and the main purpose of this whole affair is to act as a deterrent.
The Treasury Department is offering an amnesty program for Americans with secret accounts at UBS and other Swiss banks. D.C. Attorney Scott Michael says his firm has nearly 200 clients with UBS accounts who've already come forward under the program. With this settlement, many more UBS customers are now likely to do so. Michael says by agreeing to turn over the names of 5,000 possible tax evaders, UBS and Switzerland have set an important precedent that begins to lift the veil of Swiss banking secrecy.
I wouldn't be surprised if once this UBS deal is inked and the data starts flowing, if the United States then makes additional treaty requests along the same framework for customers of Credit Suisse or other financial institutions that are located in Switzerland but that have a footprint in the United States.
It's a precedent that may eventually be brought to bear on the Cayman Islands, Singapore, Liechtenstein, and many other nations that have been identified as international tax havens. Greg Allen, NPR News, Miami.
In the national healthcare debate, one fundamental question is this: how do you keep costs under control? Massachusetts have been wrestling with this issue for the past several years. Thanks to a state law passed in 2006, Massachusetts leads the nation in coverage. More than 97% of its residents now have health insurance. Well, that turned out to be the easy part. The state is struggling to hold down costs so the whole system doesn't fall apart. NPR's Richard Knox reports on how the Massachusetts experiment is working.
Dolores Mitchell is on the board that's implementing the Massachusetts healthcare law.
It has been a really notable achievement that we should be proud of.
But she admits the achievement is in jeopardy. Massachusetts has the highest health costs in the country.
I think the critical point is whether or not we can begin to do something about cost control. We've just got to do it.
So Mitchell and other health experts have drawn up an official plan to bring Massachusetts health costs under control. The first thing they decided was the current way of paying doctors and hospitals and other medical providers has to go.
It was absolutely clear. There was no argument about that.
In the world of healthcare, this is big news. Massachusetts is going to kill off fee-for-service. That's the time-honored system which pays healthcare providers a fee for every service they provide. Instead, Massachusetts policymakers want to pay doctors and hospitals a set amount per year for each patient they care for. They call it global payment.
Global means it's for all services.
That's Dr. Rick Lopez, the chief doctor at Atrius Health. It's one of the state's biggest doctor groups.
It includes when the patient comes in to see the physician, hospitalization, pharmacy, drug costs, skilled nursing facilities, home care services, the whole spectrum. That's what global means.
About half of Atrius Health's doctors are already on global payments.
Global payment actually allows us the freedom to look at the best way to provide patients care, the right time, the right place.
For instance, it allows people like Nurse Chris Roddy to pay close attention to patients who could cost Atria's Health a lot of money in hospital bills.
Morning.
Connie?
Yes?
Hi, honey. It's Chris.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, how are you?
Oh, good, thanks.
Good.
Connie Johnson is an 81-year-old patient with severe heart failure, diabetes, and a history of strokes.
Now, what was your weight this morning?
229.
229, good. Excellent, excellent, excellent.
Yeah.
The idea is to keep Connie Johnson out of the hospital.
Anything else? Oh, your blood sugar.
It was 110.
Sweet.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
It works. Beautiful. Johnson is healthier and happier, and Atria's Health saves money.
All right, my dear.
Okay.
So you know when to give me a jingle.
I'll talk to you the next time, all
okay,
right?
Honey.
It's nice that global payment can allow for encounters like this, but some worry. Global payment sounds suspiciously like the managed care and HMO plans of the 1990s. They were also based on paying healthcare providers a flat fee per patient. That experiment failed because it gave doctors and hospitals an incentive to hold back on care. To avoid a repeat, advocates of global payments say health providers will need to be watched closely.
I think you need someone monitoring this. You can't just walk away just because you've set the limit.
Nancy Kane is a Harvard healthcare financing expert who also served on the Massachusetts Payment Reform Commission. She says there are ways nowadays to prevent stinting on care.
There's a lot of quality measuring that can go on now that didn't used to be available. You know, we now have electronic medical records, easier to monitor what's going on. So I think the whole reporting system and the intention to maintain and monitoring infrastructure is all critical to avoiding the bad days of managed care.
Kane says there are also ways now to protect health plans so they don't lose their shirts taking on older or sicker patients. The stakes are high, and not just for Massachusetts.
The nation's looking at us because we've done the universal coverage, and now everybody's saying, ha, 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 we don't think that's sustainable unless you bend the cost curve. So if the if we can actually come through and do that too, I think we've shown the nation how to do it. It's huge.
The target isn't to cut out the 30% of healthcare costs that some experts call waste. It's just to reduce the amount that costs are going up.
You know, if it flattened out to no growth for 3 to 5 years, we would be ecstatic.
She says that's ambitious enough. Richard Knox, NPR News, Boston.
It's now officially election season in Illinois. Candidates this week began collecting signatures to get on the ballot in the February primary. That'll be the first statewide election since the scandal broke involving former Governor Rod Blagojevich. And during a year supposedly dedicated to cleaning up Illinois government, the question remains, how clean will the campaigns be? Sam Hudzik reports on a little piece of paper meant to make Illinois politics a bit more fair.
Here's a flashback moment to remind you just how exciting TV can be during an election season.
She's against preschool for every 3- and 4-year-old.
Took care of herself at taxpayers' expense.
Got taxpayer money for a stained glass window and a parking garage.
They've entertained him at exclusive clubs and with private dinners.
What if campaigns were different after all the political scandal? What if there were a way for politicians to tell Illinois voters, we understand you're sick of politics as usual? Something like a
code of fair campaign practices.
Yeah, something like that. And it would say something like,
I will conduct my campaign openly and publicly and limit attacks on my opponent to legitimate challenges to his record.
That's former Illinois Comptroller Don Clark-Netsch reading from an actual code that she sponsored as a state senator back in the 80s. It passed and is now part of Illinois law.
2, I will not use or permit the use of character defamation, whispering campaigns, libel, slander, or scurrilous attacks on any candidate or his personal or family life.
That code became law in 1989, but the way it's written, it's strictly voluntary. Candidates in Illinois can sign it or ignore it.
What we are trying to get people who are running for office to accept is that there is a code of decency and fairness and non-distortion that ought to be observed.
The reality is that it hasn't happened.
Richard Cowan is a former member of the State Board of Elections. He now serves on Chicago's election board.
There is no really enforcement if somebody is committing an unfair campaign practice.
About as long as the Fair Campaign Code has been around, Cowan has wanted to add some teeth to it. He says an independent commission should review campaign attacks and decide if a candidate who signed the code has violated it. He says the panel could ask candidates to take back statements.
And just as the state board has the authority to fine people for violations of the Campaign Financing Disclosure Act, in an extreme case, there could be a fine.
Cowan's proposal has never come of anything, and the lack of enforcement could be one reason why the Fair Campaign Code gets little notice. The State Board of Elections still follows the letter of the law, though, sending candidates a copy of the pledge when they first file a statement of organization. But the code is not mentioned even once in the board's 75-page candidates guide that's used by both politicians and local election officials.
You're either an ethical person or you're not. Signing a piece the paper is not going to make one ethical.
Willard Helander is clerk of Lake County, Illinois. She oversees elections there.
From my personal experience, I found the people that fill those out are often the people that probably have somewhat skeptical behavior. And the people who don't even think that way normally don't even know about the form because they just operate very fairly.
The State Election Board says more than 300 candidates signed the code during the 2008 election. That doesn't include candidates for the hundreds of county and other local races. Still, some campaign staff I talked to say they barely think about it or have never heard of it. And 20 years after her Code of Fair Campaign Practices was put on the books, Dawn Clark Netsch says she thinks campaigns are even dirtier today than they were then.
At the end of a campaign where candidates have been back and forth about he said, she said, you know, blah, 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 all that sort of stuff, you hear voters say, as far as I'm concerned, neither one of them's any good. I'm not going to vote for anybody. That's what we don't want to have happen.
This election season, like so many others, has begun with a pledge of fairness. I asked people who work for all the major campaigns for Illinois governor if the candidates planned to sign the code. All said their candidates would. I'm Sam Hudzik.
Earth and Sky.
Wednesday, August 5th, 2009. The two brightest lights in the sky in the evening hours, the Moon and Jupiter, keep each other company throughout the night tonight.
The Moon and Jupiter soar upward throughout the evening and climb to the summit of the sky around midnight. After midnight, the Moon and Jupiter descend in the west and appear low in the western sky before dawn.
It's also before dawn that a third very bright object enters the sky, Venus, which you'll find in the east before dawn, while the Moon and Jupiter are in the west tomorrow morning.
The Moon and Jupiter travel westward throughout the night for the same reason that the Sun travels westward during the day. It's because Earth spins from west to east on its axis.
According to astronomical almanacs, the moon turns full tonight at 55 minutes after midnight. That's according to the standard clock time at the Greenwich Meridian, called universal time by astronomers. But our clocks in North America say the full moon falls on Wednesday before midnight tonight. And in the world's eastern hemisphere, Europe, Africa, Asia, Australia, and New Zealand, the clocks say the moon turns full after midnight Thursday.
Tonight's moon, like any full moon, rises around sunset and sets around sunrise.